dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. To my delight, 60 Minutes provided an intelligence briefing to the American people last night. It focused on an issue that we have been very concerned about at the Center for Security Policy for, well, a decade or two, namely the vulnerability of our electric grid. The program featured the insights, the research, and the, well, mastery of the subject of one of our friends and colleagues and teammates in what we call the Secure the Grid Coalition. His name is Command Sergeant Major Mike Mabee, United States Army retired. He has spent much of his professional life protecting our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and particularly in recent years has been trying to both understand himself and explain to the rest of us just how acute is the vulnerability of our nation's most critical of critical infrastructures, namely our electric grid. He contributed mightily to the 60 Minutes piece, and we wanted to catch up with him to talk about it, congratulate him first and foremost, but also to thank him for the hard work that went into that and what he continues to do to try to protect us against, well, the possibility of a serious grid down disaster. Mike Mabee, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, my friend.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Well, again, thank you for what you did with 60 Minutes last night. One of the things that jumped out at me, Mike, in terms of the reporting and your contribution to it was what you brought to the story in terms of the fact that grid vulnerability is not an abstraction. It is a problem, an acute problem, and one that we've had plenty of warning about, including some actual efforts to take down the grid. Talk about those, if you would.
Sure. And the 60 Minutes piece last night focused on one of the threats, which is the physical threat. U.S. electric grid depends on a lot of facilities that are guarded simply by a chain link fence and some crossed fingers. And one of the real vulnerabilities is that a terrorist organization, whether a foreign terrorist organization or a domestic terrorist organization, could visit a coordinated attack against multiple of these facilities at once. And presently, there is no standard that would protect the electric grid from such an attack. Now, an example of such an attack occurred back in 2013 at the Metcalf Transformer in California, which is owned by PG&E. And in that instance, multiple assailants cut the alarm and camera wires, exited, and then with precisely aimed rifle fire, destroyed the transformers, taking that entire substation offline. Now, the transformers are the backbone of the electric grid, and they're not easily replaceable. So in normal times, the lead time to replace one transformer can run between a year to 18 months. So when you lose multiple transformers at one time, you can be talking about a blackout, you know, that can go for months or years. And that's the danger of a coordinated physical attack. Now, what the research shows is, according to Department of Energy information, in the last decade, there have been over 700 physical attacks against the U.S. electric grid.
And Mike, I guess fortuitously, providentially, none of these has translated into the kind of, well, regional blackout, let alone nationwide blackout, and sustained one at that, that you have been warning about. The Metcalf incident, which, as you say, 60 Minutes led with, was a very near-run thing. How about these other incidents? Have we really just been extremely lucky to this point, or have steps been taken by the government of the United States, by the electric utilities, by communities to greatly improve the resiliency of the grid so far?
And unfortunately, the answer to that is no. After Metcalf, there was a physical security standard enacted for part of the electric grid, which is the bulk power system or the high voltage transmission system. However, this standard was written by the regulated industry, by the electric utility industry. It wasn't written by the government. And actually, this standard enables the electric utility companies to determine which facilities the standard even applies to in the first place. So, you know, an interesting question to ponder is, you know, Metcalf, California, does that fall on that substation that was attacked? Does that fall under the physical security standard? Well, only PG&E can answer that because they're the ones that decide whether it does or it doesn't. So it's a hollow standard. There is no physical security standard for the electric grid as a whole, and the one physical security standard for the bulk power system is a complete joke.
You've described, Mike, a self-regulating industry, more or less. Yet there is at least one oversight body, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Its former chairman, John Wellinghoff, featured prominently in the 60 Minutes piece talking about the Metcalf incident. Where is FERC in all of this? And I know you've had a lot of interactions with them over the years. Are they stepping up to ensure compliance with, well, standards like this one, to say nothing of others that are needed clearly in the cyberspace and, extreme weather, space weather, and one I'm particularly concerned about, electromagnetic pulse, for example.
Right. And, you know, unfortunately, the government is not stepping up. And I think the 60 Minutes piece showed us a couple of really important key takeaways. One was from former FERC chairman John Wellinghoff, who appeared on that piece. And what he said was that FERC did a study about physical security, and if you took out less than 20 substations, you could cause a nationwide blackout. Now, Wellinghoff said less than 20, and then 60 Minutes, Bill Whitaker quoted the Wall Street Journal piece where they said the number was 9. So the frustrating part to this is that I filed a complaint about the physical security standard. And one of the specific complaint items was that it does not contemplate attacks against multiple facilities. And FERC dismissed that complaint and said, no, we don't feel the need to revisit that standard. So, you know, as we sit here, we have a former FERC chairman saying, you know, if you would do a simultaneous attack against, you know, several facilities, but less than 20, you could black out the entire nation, and yet we have the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the government, saying no further action is needed. And the other piece
was simply unbelievable. And if you hadn't followed these guys as I have, and you certainly have even more closely, you'd find this beyond comprehension. And yet, this is kind of business as usual, Mike. Is this an example of what's been called regulatory capture, in which an agency is essentially at the disposal of the entities that they're supposed to be regulating, rather than providing real oversight and enforcing sensible regulatory control?
And the, you know, answer to that, unfortunately, is yes. The electric utility industry in the last decade has spent $1.2 billion lobbying federal Congress, in addition to hundreds of millions of dollars of political contributions to members of Congress who might have, might be on committees, that would regulate the industry. Moreover, the industry, through its lobbyists, has embedded itself into the federal government through the Electric Subsector Coordinating Council and these trade associations that testify literally at every congressional and FERC hearing. So the federal government is very, very hesitant to enact any type of regulations that the electric utility industry doesn't want. And of course, the electric utility industry, you know, wants to maintain their self-regulation, does not want the government to impose any requirements related to security of the electric grid. And thus, here we are, where last night on 60 Minutes, the White House Homeland Security Advisor, Dr. Liz Sherwood Randall, admitted that the federal government does not have the ability to order or the authority to order the electric grid to protect itself from known threats. So here we have, you know, known threats that could cause the deaths of millions of people in the United States. We have an industry fighting against regulation, and we have a federal government that admits it's powerless to do anything about it.
Again, if the stakes weren't so high, this would simply be absurd, but it is outrageous. And the fact that it persists is something that requires the most urgent of attention. Mike, I want to talk to you about some things that could be done and should be done, perhaps starting with tomorrow night's State of the Union address by President Joe Biden. But before we do that, just one other piece of this that is so striking is that, as 60 Minutes exposed, there really isn't anybody in the government on the policy side, not the regulatory side, but the policy side, who is responsible for the grid's resiliency. How could that possibly be? And what do we have instead?
Well, we have a self-regulatory system, and the grid has always been self-regulated. And in the United States, we have a lot of self-regulated areas. And in most instances, we found a way to make that work. And I'll give you a great example is Wall Street. After the financial scandals in 2008 with subprime mortgage, Congress enacted the Dodd-Frank Act, and after the Enron debacle, they had enacted the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. So we know how to hold industries accountable even when they're self-regulated. But in the electric utility industry, there's absolutely nobody holding the industry accountable or the government accountable. And a great example of that is the 246 deaths in Texas from the February 2021 blackout. Nobody has been held accountable for those deaths, even though that blackout was a repeat offense. The same thing happened in 1989 and 2011. So we have no accountability right now with the electric utility industry, and that is a key thing that needs to change.
Mike, I'm often asked when talking about this with people, why would the electric utilities be so resistant to taking the sorts of steps that would make their infrastructure less susceptible to, well, sabotage or cyber warfare or extreme weather or, this naturally occurring geomagnetic disturbance or its man-made counterpart, electromagnetic pulse. Don't they have families, I'm often asked? Don't they have customers, for heaven's sakes? Doesn't their whole business model depend on being able to sell electricity to people? And that would seem to be a pretty compelling reason for them to be doing something about these problems. And yet, as you say, they're not. Why?
Yeah. And, I have pondered that question for years because it doesn't seem to make any sense. But, at the end of the day, the most industries tend to be anti-regulation. They don't want, the government to regulate them any more than it does. And I get it. That's the way it is. And these industries have these powerful lobbying organizations that, by the way, the electric ratepayers are paying for all this lobbying through their electric bills. But they have these organizations that, spend a great deal of money lobbying against regulation. Meanwhile, if you're one of these 3,000 entities in the electric grid and you want to do the right thing, it's very, very hard to justify spending a lot of money on security if nobody else is doing it, if it's not a requirement, just because it's the right thing. We've, you know, got shareholders we have to please, you know, and, you know, can we justify spending this money? So you make yourself less competitive if you want to, you know, spend a lot of money on extra unrequired, you know, air quote, security measures. So that's one of the problems, is just the culture in the electric utility industry is not conducive, and you know, and they're not held accountable. So if there is a blackout and people die, they don't get held accountable for that if it was preventable.
And, well, but we've mentioned PG&E, this company out in California that had this major substation very, very nearly taken down for, well, possibly years. They have also been, of course, the entity that has been repeatedly found liable for wildfires. And they have been held accountable for that. They have spent, I think, tens of billions of dollars, if I'm not mistaken, compensating people for the losses incurred as a result. So surely they can't be completely indifferent to these kinds of risks and the need to mitigate them.
Well, first of all, PG&E is a convicted felon. They, were convicted of 85 felony counts in the Camp Fire. So to the extent that, you know, we want to view a convicted, you know, felon like PG&E as a credible, you know, source, good luck to all of us. But the industry has a history of bad actors within the industry. You know, we only have to, you know, look towards PG&E, Enron, the Ohio-Illinois First Energy scandal. So, you know, this is an industry with a checkered past. And, you know, the government is completely trusting this industry, you know, to do the right thing with security. And there are within the industry some, you know, real beacons of hope, you know, where we've got some companies that really are trying to do the right thing. But by and large, the culture has got to change. There has got to be accountability within the industry and the government to protect the grid. And, you know, presently without that, we've got 3,000 barn doors to guard.
We're talking with Command Sergeant Major Mike Mabee, United States Army retired, a leader of our Secure the Grid Coalition, and an indefatigable champion of accountability for those who fail to make this, as I say, most critical of critical infrastructures as resilient as we possibly can against all hazards. And when I say most critical infrastructures, it is that because, as you know, Mike, without electricity, none of the other critical infrastructures in this country work, and people will die, possibly by the millions. So this brings us to what can be done about it. I mentioned earlier, Mike, that the President of the United States is going to be making a major report to the Congress, his first, in this case, annual State of the Union address. Do you have any thoughts about what Joe Biden could do in the way of announcements? These speeches are always chock-a-block with different initiatives and promises, but specific things that he could announce tomorrow night that could set this nation on the road to actually having the grid made, if not actually completely invulnerable, at least much less vulnerable than it currently is to catastrophic attack or other induced failure.
Yeah, and there absolutely are actions that could be taken. And I would, you know, implore the president, if he happens to be listening to your show, Frank, that at the Union address, you need to announce, Mr. President, that you are going to be working with Congress to make protection of the electric grid mandatory. There's just no other two ways about it. The federal government has got to step up and make, protection of the electric grid against, against the known threats mandatory. We need to require that companies within the electric utility industry take reasonably prudent steps to protect themselves, you know, their equipment, their piece of the grid against known hazards. And that has got to be certified by the chief executive officer of each of those entities, at least on an annual basis, and the government's got to monitor this. There have to be civil and criminal penalties for false certification, and we've got to put the onus on the owners and operators of the electric utility industry, of the electric grid, to protect their piece of it, to take reasonably prudent measures. Right now, that requirement does not exist. So that would be the first thing that the president should announce, his initiative to make the protection of the electric grid mandatory.
Okay. When you look at the need for someone to be in charge of enforcing this kind of statute, and otherwise pulling the government together, comprehensively to make grid resiliency a national priority, shouldn't that be one of the other things he sets in train? And could he do that by executive direction rather than require possibly time-consuming legislation?
Yes. And, we do not presently have anybody in charge in the federal government, as, we saw in the 60 Minutes piece last night, where the White House, admitted that, there literally is nobody in charge. So, directing that new position of a, grid security czar, for lack of a better word, in the White House, or at a very, I would say it really should be at the White House. The other place it could possibly be is, high level at DOE, but then that tends to get even more buried in the bureaucracy. So I think having a grid security czar at the White House.
It has to be in the White House. Yeah, I think you're right.
And it's got to be somebody that's got the mandate and the resources to get the job done, to pull together the national labs, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Department of Energy, and the 50 state PUC. We've got to coordinate
public
with
utility
all of
commissions.
Regulators,
yeah.
Public utility commissions. We've got to coordinate, we've got to have somebody that's coordinating grid security with all of these entities and is able to credibly testify to Congress about and be held accountable by Congress as to what the government is doing about this problem. And, right now we don't have anybody in that position.
Right. Mike, we're almost out of time. I think there are two other questions that I know you've been working hard on. One is the issue of, can we protect people working in the electric utility who may have insights into problems that are clearly national security, homeland security sensitive, shall we say, if not highly destructive, point one. And point two, the fact that we've allowed foreign equipment, including from communist China, in our electric grid. Talk quickly about what President Biden might do on those two fronts tomorrow night.
Sure. And, we know in the United States about enacting whistleblower provisions or employee protections for people in certain industries. So, for example, in the nuclear industry, employees are protected if they blow the whistle on violations of Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations, that might impact the safety of a nuclear power plant, something that would be very important to people. So we know how to protect employees within an industry who are in a position to see wrongdoing or, to see violations. And the administration should work with Congress to enact whistleblower protections to protect employees of the electric grid. Presently, that doesn't exist. If an employee in the electric grid blew the whistle on a violation of, NERC critical infrastructure and protection standards and, was fired, that employee would have no protection under federal law. And that has got to change, in order to bring, accountability to the industry and to empower employees to point out regulatory violations. And then the other point you raise about foreign equipment, well, our research has revealed that we have imported over 370 large Chinese transformers and installed them into the electric grid.
Oh, my Lord.
Now,
that's out of a total of how many, Mike?
I'm not sure how many there are total, but the thing is, the number of Chinese transformers has been increasing that we are ordering because the Chinese are marketing very well, and they're probably underselling some of our other more traditional sources.
We can count on
so
it.
So people,
that's what they do.
We don't
low bid.
We don't make a lot of these transformers in the United States anymore. We make very, very few. The vast majority of these large transformers we have to import, and traditionally we've imported them from South Korea, Germany, European countries. But in more recent years, we've started importing these from the Chinese. Now, not only are we importing these large transformers, but we are importing millions of smart meters and inverters. And the inverters are particularly important with renewable energy. And we're installing all of this equipment.
Also importing them from China?
From China. Yep. From communist China. We're importing all of this equipment and installing it on the electric grid. And there's absolutely no requirement that anybody check any of it for vulnerabilities.
And Mike, what kinds of vulnerabilities could you see the Chinese building into such equipment if they were of a mind to, for example, take down our grid as an act of war against the United States?
Right. And the first thing we should note is that the People's Republic of China has been hacking the U.S. energy sector since at least 2003. That we know of. So yes, they're doing it. They reside comfortably today in our electric grid, along with the Russians. So if you've got a nation state actor such as communist China that's already hacked your electric grid, why on earth would you buy components from them to install into the electric grid? Because those components could have hidden backdoors, ways for their hackers to access them. And if nothing else, since they manufactured them, they know all about them and they know how to defeat, any type of safety measures that the devices may have.
Yeah. And ways to break them besides just, backdoor cyber techniques, perhaps. So, Mike, it's insane again. It's irresponsible. It's recklessly dangerous, and it's going to get Americans killed. And it's unconscionable that despite your best efforts, our Secure the Grid Coalition and others, to raise a ruckus about this, that so little has been done, if anything. I understand there actually has been an investigation of one of these Chinese transformers, and that it was unfortunately, confirming of our worst fears. Is that right?
Yes. So there was one Chinese transformer, and this was reported in a Wall Street Journal article, that was seized by the government and taken to Sandia National Laboratories. Now, the government has not said a peep about what, if anything, they found. But, when you seize a multi-million dollar transformer and bring it to the national labs, obviously that's a pretty remarkable event. However, one former White House official, Latham Sadler, who formerly worked for the National Security Council, confirmed in an interview that the National Lab did find a backdoor vulnerability in that transformer. So we haven't had anything official from the government, but we have had a former government official who said in an interview that something was found. But regardless, there is no that was just one transformer that was seized, but there is no requirement. So it's just like giving ammunition to the guy that's shooting at, that we're not having any requirements to check this Chinese equipment before it gets installed onto the grid.
Well, it's buying the bullets for him to shoot at you, to use your metaphor. Lastly, and very quickly, Mike, maybe, are we in a position to do anything about these kind of hardware problems at the moment? Is there any alternative to continuing to rely on Chinese-produced equipment in all of these regards?
Well, I think, the best solution would be we should make stuff in America and use American-made stuff that's vetted. That obviously would be the holy grail solution. But I think at a minimum, we need to have requirements that any equipment that's bought and installed in our critical infrastructure be checked for vulnerabilities. And presently, there is no requirement, as to where you source your equipment from, who you can buy it from, and, whether you check it. There's no requirement.
Again, this is lunacy. Mike, maybe you bring sanity to so much of this. I pray that your good work at 60 Minutes last night, and how can people see the video, Mike, if they weren't able to catch it in real time?
Yep. If you weren't able to catch it, if you go up to either my website, gridsecuritynow.org, or the Secure the Grid website, which is securethegrid.com. We will have that video posted on both of those sites so that you can see it.
Mike, maybe I hope everyone will look at this video, will take to heart some of your very important warnings both there and here, and that most especially President Joe Biden will heed these calls for practical near-term steps that could make a huge difference for all of us. God bless you, my friend. Keep up your great work with the Secure the Grid Coalition. And by the way, people, you can follow that work and much more at securethegrid.com. We need to get these problems addressed and addressed properly immediately. Thank you, Mike Mabee, to come back to us with updates if you would. Next up, we'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 50 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon went to Communist China. The object was what his successors of both parties have done ever since, namely seeking China's assistance with some American priority or another, from countering the Soviet threat to help in ending the Vietnam War, to opening markets, to mitigating climate change. Whatever the U.S. motivation for engaging with the ruling Chinese Communist Party, the actual effect 5 decades later is clear. The CCP has eaten our lunch. Instead of enriching the Chinese communists, translating into actual help from Beijing, let alone making them more like us, we have simply enabled China to wage what the CCP calls unrestricted warfare against this country and the free world, or generally. It's absolutely insane for us to persist in engaging with, let alone continuing underwriting, our most dangerous enemy ever. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and we are continuing the visits with great Americans here at the Conservative Political Action Conference 2022 in Orlando, Florida. And we have one across the table at the moment. His name is Eric Greitens. I'm delighted to call him a friend, as well as a man that I have come to admire greatly for his service to our country in a number of capacities, notably as a Navy SEAL, a lieutenant commander, as I recall, when you retired. A lot of combat experience over the years, among other combat in the political warfare space.
Yes.
As a governor of the state of Missouri.
Yes.
He is at the moment running for the United States Senate.
Yes.
And I am just thrilled to have a chance to catch up with you about
it's so good to be with you,
so
sir.
Many things that yes. in your past lives, as well as your present one, you were yes. focused on like a laser.
100%. 100%. Great to be on with you.
Let's start with the state of the world.
Yes.
And specifically what you make
yes.
of not just the sort of microcosmic crisis of the moment
yes.
in Ukraine, but what it portends.
Yeah, I think, Frank, so honored to be on with you, sir. Thank you always for bringing such informed and thoughtful analysis to your audience. Well, and I think
it's because I've got good guests who do it.
Well,
I'm just
the
conveyor belt.
Thank you. But I think you're right. Let's take a step back and look strategically at where we're at. And let's look historically. Keep in mind, just 30 years ago, you had people writing books about the, quote, end of history, because they thought that the United States of America had proven once and for all that it was here with our republic that we had finally answered the question as to how human society should be organized.
Right.
And yet now,
permanently,
that's what people thought. And yet, just 30 years later, and really, we've seen just since the Biden administration took over, a tremendous policy of weakness and chaos, which has put us in a dangerous place. Mm. The world is always at its best when America is at its strongest. Mm-hmm. That was true in World War II. It was true throughout the Cold War, and it was true in the post-Cold War era. And it's important for people to recognize, what does that really mean? And it means that there is a policy of peace through strength. What kind of policy did we pursue during the Cold War? It was a policy of peace through strength. And when there were moments of weakness, we invited aggression. When Khrushchev saw Kennedy fail at the Bay of Pigs, what happened? They started putting missiles in Cuba, so Kennedy had to respond. That moment of weakness in the Bay of Pigs invited aggression. The United States had to respond. What are we seeing? What we see
and
today?
At yes, the sir. Time,
yes,
it had the capability to respond decisively.
That's right.
Not just
yes.
because Cuba was nearby, but also because it was strong vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
Yes, exactly. And we, the United States of America, made a decision to respond decisively.
Right.
And what did we see in the Trump era? We saw a policy of peace through strength. And again, let's talk specifics.
Very explicitly.
He said explicitly.
That's what he was seeking to emulate.
Yes. And it was more than a phrase. Mm-hmm. Okay. So President Trump did things that were not only opposed to leftists, but sometimes opposed to his own Republican establishment. When, for example, he moved the United States Embassy to Jerusalem. When he recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. When he killed the Iranian butcher Qasem Soleimani, when he defeated ISIS, what you saw was that President Trump did two things. One, he put an end to endless wars. And two, when military force and a response was necessary, he acted decisively and it sent a clear message to the world. What were the fruits of that? You saw the fruits of that policy of peace through strength in the historic Abraham Accords. And it's important for people to recognize this was the first time that Israel had normalized relations with an Arab neighbor. You had to go back to 1994 in Jordan. Before that, it was 1979 with Egypt. President Trump got it done multiple times. I've said before, and I'll say again, I believe that he and his team deserve the Nobel Peace Prize for the work that they did there.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second that I believe... And we spend a lot of time on this program monitoring the wrecking operation that the Biden administration represents across the board.
Yes.
There are few places where it is more dramatic, it seems to me, speaking of the Abraham Accords, than with respect to the position Israel was in at the end of his administration and the position it's in at the moment.
Correct.
And you know, all this talk about a new joint comprehensive plan of action or some other nonsense with the Iranians doesn't conceal for a moment the fact that by essentially trashing those accords and making the most appalling, sickening, really, submission to the Iranians in the hope that they'll somehow paper up again their false promises of giving up nuclear weapons. We really are witnessing Israel put in mortal peril. And I know this is on your heart and something that you've devoted
100%
much of your life to preventing.
Look, we're recognizing Israel being put in mortal peril. And look, I served as a Navy SEAL. I've also visited the Israeli equivalent of the Navy SEALs over in Israel. I've been on their base. Those men and women do an extraordinary job every single day because the state of Israel is under constant threat.
Yes.
And again, the contrast between President Trump, who was willing to kill Qasem Soleimani and send a very strong message to Iran, compared to Joe Biden, who's basically, again, this policy of weakness and accommodation with Iran has invited aggression. And then what happens? It means that allies or potential allies, what? You see, Saudi Arabia just signed a new military cooperation agreement with Russia. This is what happens when America is weak. And that's what we're seeing from Biden is a policy of weakness.
You know, I did a commentary this week about the fact that, sadly, the question of whether or not this is going to metastasize into future much more serious problems with the Chinese, notably, perhaps others, is a function of both whether we demonstrate the resolve as well as the strength to resist.
Yes.
Or failing that.
Yes.
Countries that we're concerned, consider today, let me put it this way. Countries that we consider today our allies are going to decide, and Saudi Arabia is a perfect example of this, that they're better off making a separate peace with our enemies rather than relying on our unreliable
100%. And when you have a situation, for example, with, you know, Germany, historically, obviously one of our NATO allies, who now is receiving you know, a huge percentage of their domestic energy directly from Russia.
Right.
Okay.
And benefiting by selling much more of it to everybody else in Europe.
Yes. And so what's happened, and again, I so appreciate, Frank, the way that you bring the historical perspective in the details to folks, is that people are seeing the fruits of Biden's weakness. Mm-hmm. You're seeing that sour, rotten fruit that comes from weakness. A policy of strength leads to peace. And we also have to recognize, and others have touched on it, Afghanistan was a definitive moment in American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And it was a terrible moment in American foreign policy. And, you know, look, I served as a Navy SEAL. I flew in and out of Bagram Air Base. And people would always come up to me and they'd ask me, they said, can you explain to us what they were thinking? The short answer is no. You could have had a group of fifth graders who would have better organized an evacuation there. Everybody knows you get your civilians out first and then you take your military out. You don't leave tens of billions of dollars of military equipment behind.
Unless it is a wrecking operation. Unless what you were dueling deliberately, and our previous guest on our program was Trevor Loudon, was talking about the Chinese being the principal beneficiary of this, and a guy owned by the Chinese Communist Party engineered that. So I don't want to write this off to incompetence or, you know,
this was my speech yesterday. Good. My speech at CPAC, I said, look, we have to recognize the nature of the enemy we're facing. This is evil. I said the left is actively trying to destroy our country. And I literally said, when you leave tens of billions of dollars of military equipment behind that benefits China, Russia, and the Taliban, people want to say, well, Joe Biden is senile and Kamala Harris is incompetent. That's true, but it's more than that. This is real evil. The choice to open America's border, the choice to divide us with critical race theory, the choice to defund the police and have historic murders here at home, the choice to attack America's energy independence on day one by killing the Keystone XL pipeline. These are all actions that have been specifically taken to destroy the country. And what's so important is that everyone who's listening to this, that we all recognize the nature of the enemy that we're facing and the moment we're in. And Frank, I tell people, I say sometimes I thought to myself, well, our enemies are Al-Qaeda and Abu Sayyaf and Jamaat Islamiyah and ISIS. And I thought, well, maybe this domestic part is an anachronism from our founding fathers. But in fact, our domestic enemies are more real and represent a greater threat to the United States than our foreign enemies. And that's why we must stand up, defeat the left. And I've been telling people, if you're on the sidelines, you're on the wrong side. This is a fight where everyone who's listening to you right now, Frank, they got to get involved, stay involved so that we can take our republic back.
Amen. Well said and needed so desperately. And congratulations on saying it here at CPAC. Let me just drill down on two points, that are not unrelated.
Yes.
One of the other terrible examples of the wrecking operation, as you know so well, is the border insecurity.
Yes.
It isn't even possible to call it security at all, in or otherwise. There is none.
Yes.
It's an open border at the moment, as you know. That has resulted in infusions of large numbers of people, most of whom we have no knowledge of, let alone what their reason for coming here might be.
Yes.
In addition, speaking of Afghanistan,
yes.
As a result of that debacle,
yes.
The wrecking operation brought, pick a number, 100,000 or so people, most of them men of military age, who again have not been vetted.
Yes.
And I'm sure some of them are winding up in the state of Missouri.
Yes.
As they are states all across this country.
Yes.
As a serious national security practitioner and professional, as well as a political figure, what are the implications of these two phenomena and the degree to which they're compounded by a lack of knowledge of the full magnitude of it?
Frank, I'm so glad you're talking about this. Not enough people are. It is a massive national security threat. And I'll tell you, I went down to the border, not just to the Texas and Arizona side, but more importantly, I went to the Mexican side of the border. So all of your listeners should know, we have right now between 600,000 to 1 million people who are crossing every single month into the United States of America.
Say that again.
Between 600,000 to 1 million people were crossing every month
into the
United States of America.
I thought last year was 2 million total.
I
know that that's not taking into account the getaways. But
the Customs and Border Patrol,
is that right?
The Customs and Border Patrol is in contact with about 200,000 people a month, and they estimate that they're only in touch with one-third to one-fifth of all of the people who cross. And here's also the worst part.
Was that, huh?
When you go down to the border, when you literally, I walk down to the front lines, that's what I do as a Navy SEAL, you walk down to the front lines of the river, it is littered with IDs. Mm-hmm. Thousands of identification cards dumped there. And you ask yourself why. It's because everyone who wants to cross into the United States, they drop their IDs on the Mexican side of the border. They walk across the river. They're not trying to get away from Biden's Customs and Border Patrol. Often they walk right up to them. Those Customs and Border Patrol agents then take them, they deliver them to a processing station, and then they're sent right into the United States of America. Well, to give you some examples, I picked up IDs, Frank, from Egypt and from the United Arab Emirates. Now, obviously, we can't know any individual's particular story, but we know about terrorist organizations that operate out of Egypt. Interestingly, the UAE ID that I picked up was of a Nigerian who'd been living in the UAE, and the UAE had just arrested several Nigerians for raising funds for Boko Haram in the UAE. Now, again, we don't know these individuals' particular stories, but here's what I do know.
Boko Haram, of course, is in
Nigeria. Is in Nigeria. Yes,
but
yes.
They were
Boko
the
Haram.
They're
raising the funds in the UAE. And here's the key thing, is that I served as a Navy SEAL, fought against Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Abu Sayyaf, Hamas, Lamia. The fact is we face an extraordinarily determined, very intelligent enemy who is willing to do anything to defeat us. And now we have a wide open border. If anyone wants to send a terrorist operative into the United States of America, all they have to do is get into Mexico and they can walk straight across.
Or perhaps get on the ramp of a C-17 coming out of Afghanistan.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. It's another example.
American expense.
Yes. Yeah, where again, the Americans haven't, you know, we have not properly vetted those people who are coming over. So you have that happening from Afghanistan. You have everyone coming across the Mexican border. It is a major national security threat as well as a humanitarian tragedy, right? As well as a major economic issue. So we need to go back to not only President Trump's policy of peace through strength overseas, but also we need a strong border policy.
Big time. Last question.
Yes,
sir. And this is a little probably out of the blue for you, but I think it's important to call attention to it wherever we can. There was an incident, as you know, 6 weeks or so ago, I guess now, in Texas, Colleyville, Texas, where a Jewish synagogue had the terrorist enter and take hostages.
Yes.
Fortunately, he was killed and the hostages got away unscathed, obviously.
Yes.
Traumatized, but nonetheless physically unscathed. We're told that the reason that he wanted to take those hostages and perhaps to execute them if he could have as part of the jihad was to free a woman by the name of Afia Siddiqui. Mm. I don't know if you know anything about her story, but it's fascinating. One of our colleagues frequently on War Room with you and me and others, Sam Faddis, may, as you perhaps know, worked in his last duty station for the Central Intelligence Agency as the director of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit.
Yes.
And he talks about how this woman was one of the highest priorities for his office to neutralize because she was considered to be an extremely dangerous individual.
Yes.
She's now in prison in the United States.
Right.
And the reason I'm asking, Eric, is that it's not just this terrorist who's trying to spring her. Every Muslim Brotherhood front organization, as far as I can tell, is also, even now, after this incident, still championing her release. And Sam Faddis says, if you're trying to get her out, you're trying to kill large numbers of Americans because that's the business she's in.
Yes.
Any thoughts on sort of the microcosmic story here, but more generally, about this enemy within problem of Islamists, Sharia supremacists, Muslim Brotherhood, whatever you want to call them.
Yes. Well, look, we need to recognize the nature of the enemy that we're facing. We talked about the leftist enemy, and absolutely, We have enemies who would love nothing more than to commit an act of mass terrorism in the United States of America.
They think it's God's will.
They do. They believe that this is their mission. They are determined to do it. And unfortunately, because Joe Biden has opened the border, unfortunately, because he's not vetting people coming from Afghanistan, he has made that more likely rather than less. And consistently what we've seen is that policy after policy from the Biden administration is not only making us weaker, but it's endangering every single one of your listeners.
Amen. The wrecking operation in full tilt. Eric Greitens, thank you very much for joining us, for your past service to our country, both in the state of Missouri and, of course, at the national level in the SEALs. Thank you for putting yourself in the arena again.
You're welcome, sir.
We wish you the best and look forward to talking with you further as this progresses.
We'll win this fight and take our country back. We have to. God bless you.
From your lips to God's ears. Thank you.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. 50 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon went to communist China. The object was what his successors of both parties have done ever since, namely seeking China's assistance with some American priority or another, from countering the Soviet threat to help in ending the Vietnam War to opening markets to mitigating climate change. Whatever the U.S. motivation for engaging with the ruling Chinese Communist Party, the actual effect 5 decades later is clear. The CCP has eaten our lunch. Instead of enriching the Chinese communists, translating into actual help from Beijing, let alone making them more like us, we have simply enabled China to wage what the CCP calls unrestricted warfare against this country and the free world, or generally. It's absolutely insane for us to persist in engaging with, let alone continuing underwriting, our most dangerous enemy ever. This is Frank Gaffney.
This day, February 28, 1781, wrote in his will, "As my children may be impressed with the last words of their father, I think it proper here not only to subscribe to the Christian religion, but also in the heart of a father's affection to charge them to remember that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.